Well, hello, fellow podcast listener, and welcome to the latest episode of the Pop Culture Pub. Now, for this episode, originally this was going to be a singular episode about the film Bohemian Rhapsody, and we were also going to discuss the band Queen, of which the film Bohemian Rhapsody is about. But there was so much material that I decided to split this into a two-part episode. So the first episode is going to be a Bohemian Rhapsody movie discussion with some Queen discussion. And then part two of this two-part episode will be a Queen discussion with some Bohemian Rhapsody discussion involved. So thank you for listening, and on with the show. Fellow podcast listener, and welcome to the Pop Culture Pub. This is our Bohemian Rhapsody movie and Queen discussion. I know by the time you hear this, you're gonna if you are a listener of the podcast, you probably listened to our previous episode, which was our Avengers Infinity War / Endgame discussion, and on that episode I said our next episode was going to be annoying things in pop culture, but unfortunately we had a scheduling snafu, which sometimes happens with podcasting. My sister had a baby the night that Jason and I were going to record that episode, so I was 2 hours away in the city while my sister gave birth, so I could meet my nephew, so we had to reschedule. So, as it turns out, I also had this episode planned with my guests this evening, and so that's why it's on the feed first, because we didn't have to reschedule this episode. So, joining me this week is one of my oldest podcasting friends. We started podcasting together 2012, all the way back in the Geek Fallout days, and it's Richard Reeder. How's it going, Rich?
Hey, how's it going? I'm doing pretty good, can't complain. Congratulations to you and your family on a new member.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, having nephews and nieces is awesome, because I get to be the cool uncle. I get to be the uncle that comes over, I get to spoil, I get to, you know, fill them full of chocolate and candy, and then I get to go home. And I get to relax, and I get to have a nap.
Exactly. My niece is still very young, so I haven't hit the spoiling stage yet, but I'm very excited for that point to happen.
Yeah. No, I was very excited, because you see, my sister, she got to play this role, like, you know, 10 years ago, right? She got to be the cool aunt. She, you know, her and her husband would, you know, come over. They didn't have kids, would come over and spoil and you know, buy my kids, you know, like kid drum sets, for example, and think it was funny. And now I get to do this thing. I get to do these things because my kids are older. Like, my son's out of school already. He's, you know, working, and my oldest daughter is going to be graduating next year. And then my youngest daughter, she's still got 4 years left in school, but it's going by fast. It's crazy.
So this is your sister's first child or her second?
Her third.
Oh, third. Okay, I was going to say, this isn't their first. I'm pretty sure I've seen pictures, like family photos of you guys or something, where there's been some Red Balls in there. Am I getting that right? Red Ball?
Red Ball, yep. Yep. Yeah. Their oldest son is, he was born 2011, October. So basically almost a year before I started podcasting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, the sound engineer for my original podcast, Random Nerdness, was my brother-in-law, Sebastian. So
which I sincerely miss him from the podcasting world. He was a good talent behind and in front of the microphone, actually.
Oh yeah, no, it he was awesome. Definitely made me sound a lot better, and his equipment's amazing. Like, because my brother-in-law went to school for sound engineering. Like, he actually did that. He's not using his schooling now. Like, he's not a sound engineer, but he does it for fun, right? And he's also nice. A musician. So, like, him and his yeah, him and his friends have done demos, and he was part of a band for a while, and he's a sound expert. You know, so what little I know, I've learned, well, from you, Rich, and from Sebastian, in terms of editing and stuff. So
yeah, nice.
Definitely, I'd love him and I keep talking about doing like a live episode, which we did a couple times. Did one.
You mean
over
just like together live, or do you mean live as in like in front of an audience?
In front of an audience, we did that a couple times. It was called Podcasting and Beverages. We did that.
Really?
Yeah, we did that in 2014 on Geek Fallout. And I know because I'm looking at the little posters I made for it. So that was September 19th, 2014. We did a live recording at his house. I remember we did it in his yard. I had a couple of friends that I met down at the Vulcan Star Trek convention. They came up. And there was about five or six of us. So it was a lot of fun. And then we also did one November 15th, 2014, in his basement. And that was for the Random Nerdness podcast. And that was our top five best and worst TV series finales.
Interesting.
Yeah, for that one, I think we had probably 10 people there. It was tough. It really is. Because people start talking and chatting with each other while they're sitting there, but they don't realize, like, Sebastian's microphone picks up everything.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because he's got this really awesome setup, and it would pick up a pin drop. that one was a little tough, having that many people there. But, we keep talking about doing it.
I'm talking to a couple different people right now in Ottawa about doing a, I don't want to say live in the same sense, but a live recording in the sense that, like, we're going to go to a local bar or comic mm-hmm. book shop and record an episode about comics. And so it should be very interesting, considering I will just have my Zoom mobile recorder, which has two microphones on it. And okay. I'll just kind of put it in the middle of the table, much like a press person would or something. And you just kind of press record and we'll see how the sound is. But unfortunately, the two people that I want to do the show with, neither of them have a microphone rig set up or anything. Right. Because one of them, Chris Gaida, I mm-hmm. talked to him, finally spoke to him the other day. And he said he'd be interested in doing something like that, so we just have to find a spot. And then I found another guy who actually runs a popular, I think it's called the Extraordinary Nerds and Geeks of Ottawa Area or something mm-hmm. like that. So it's a Facebook group in Ottawa that's got about 7,000 people in it, I want to say, and he's one of the admins. And so I invited him nice. On, so we're going to do a live recording about comic books in either a comic book shop or maybe one of the barcades here in Ottawa.
That should be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should be fun.
I really envy you guys. Cause I know like Toronto's got those barcades too. And you guys got them. Like, I don't think Edmonton has anything like that.
There must be at least one.
Maybe not that I know of, like I haven't seen them. But yeah, that would be a lot of fun. Yeah. Well, at the end of the episode, Rich, we're going to talk a little bit more about your podcast because I want the listeners to check out your podcast because you're going to be doing some interesting stuff coming up. So we'll get back to that once we're done.
Yeah, for sure.
This topic. So let's get right into it. For this episode, as I mentioned, we are talking about the film Bohemian Rhapsody, which was a movie that they did last November about the band Queen, and then later, as the episode progresses, we will shift more to a Queen discussion. So for this episode, I got a number of questions lined up that I'll be asking Rich, and I'll be answering myself. So to start off, what was your knowledge of Queen prior to this film, Rich? What did you know about Queen before you watched this movie?
Well, I'm going to kind of take it even a step further and just say before I knew of this movie being filmed, because once I heard that the movie was coming, especially once they actually confirmed it and started actually, you know, filming it, and it was like a hard yes, it's coming, and not just like, yeah, we're thinking about maybe Sacha Baron Cohen, and you know what I mean? Like before they hammered it down and everything, I would say I had a base knowledge of Queen in the sense that I grew up listening to a lot of classic rock. My father is a classic rock type of guy. We bonded in my teens by going to classic rock concerts. Thankfully, all those old bands are all very broke and need money for drugs, booze, and their families and their ex-wives. So they all still tour. So that was our big bonding thing. Like, I've seen just about everybody under the sun except for Queen, obviously, for obvious reasons. And so I had a very base knowledge. I don't think I could sit there and name anybody in the band other than Freddie Mercury, and I don't think I would be able to necessarily sit there and name off albums or anything like that, but I knew, I definitely knew a few songs and enjoyed quite a few of their songs, so I had a very basic knowledge of the band before this, for sure.
I would say I was a little bit more than basic knowledge for myself. Like, to be honest with you, like, Queen has always been one of my favorite bands. And I actually went back into my archives, back my old blogs that I used to do, from 2009. And I actually did one where I listed off my 10 favorite bands / musical acts of all time. And Queen, in 2009, I had listed as number 9.
Oh, wow.
So, I'm kind of disappointed in myself that I didn't have them a little bit higher up when I look at some of the other ones I had ahead of them. Because, you know, my musical taste, like, I've developed more
of a... Who were ahead of them? Now I need to know. You can't just leave us and the listeners hanging. Okay. Who was ahead of them?
Well, I had AC/DC, The Tragically Hip, Metallica, Nirvana, The Beatles... Elvis.
Wow, Nirvana was ahead of Queen.
Yeah.
Nirvana was on your list at all. I'm actually kind of surprised at that.
Oh, I love Nirvana. I'm a huge Nirvana fan.
Now, are we sure it's not Nirvana?
I've always said Nirvana.
Me too. It might be a Canadian thing. I'm not sure. I have heard people say Nirvana before, though.
And I actually do have a couple stories of Nirvana relating to Queen that I'll share later in this episode. But yeah, I think, I had Meatloaf on there as well. I can't remember who else.
And those were all ahead of Queen, or those were just on the list?
Yes. Well, as I said, Queen was number 9, and behind Queen I had Madonna. Because I've always had a thing for Madonna. But anyway, I think I even had Michael Jackson ahead of Queen.
Well, I mean, that's not unfair necessarily. I mean, all of those bands are arguably, you know, like top list for, you know, millions of people around the world for
definitely,
sure. Like
definitely.
They're all amazing bands.
After having watched Bohemian Rhapsody, and I'll discuss this a little bit further, Queen is actually at the top of my list now.
I couldn't tell from all of your posts.
Yeah, I've really developed an appreciation for Queen, but I'll get more into that later. But yeah, going into this film, as I said, I've always been a fan of Queen, but I've always been a fan of their greatest hits. Like, I remember back in the late 80s, of course, I remember Another One Bites the Dust. I remember We Are the Champions, because every time they, because I am an Edmonton Oilers fan, and I grew up in an Edmonton Oilers house because my dad's my dad's a huge fan.
Sens forever, boo.
Yeah, well, back then the Sens didn't even exist.
No, I know it did.
So every time they would win the Stanley Cup, you know, like that's what they would play is We Are the Champions.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like every time they would do the parade downtown Edmonton with the Stanley Cup, it was We Are the Champions. You know, of course, Another One Bites the Dust, We Will Rock You, and then of course Bohemian Rhapsody with, you know, the Wayne's World film. Wayne's World, when that movie came out, I probably watched it like 200 times. I loved that movie.
Oh yeah, and that one scene too is amazing.
Yeah, sure. So I used to have the Greatest Hits cassette when I was a kid. Actually, both of them, because they had two different volumes. And then in the early 2000s, I got the three-disc Greatest Hits CDs, which I somehow lost, like, because I moved a few times, and I lost one of my CD. Remember when we used to have the CD wallets, like when you would, you know, the sleeves or whatever? I lost one of those. So my Queen CDs went with them. But fortunately, I was smart enough to have it on my computer. I saved all my CDs on computer. So I've always had them on, you know, on my USB. They're in my rotation of music. But I never actually like watched like a Queen music video. I never watched a documentary about them. Of course, like you said, like I knew who Freddie Mercury was. I knew, you know, that he died of AIDS. And every time I think of Freddie Mercury prior to this film, I would just think of the short hair, the mustache.
The 80s Freddie Mercury.
Yes, the 80s version. That's
yes, like same
I
here.
Said,
yep.
Like I said, I never watched any other music videos or anything.
But I didn't even really know they had any up until the movie, actually.
Well, and that's the thing. Like they made the first music video, like for Bohemian Rhapsody, because that never had been done before.
That was the first music video?
The first real
music video. Or the first UK music video, or?
Well, it depends who you talk to, but yeah, it was like 1974.
Definitely one of the first, I guess.
It was the first one that they ever really did like that. You know, like music videos back in the day were just like filming the band, you know, playing their instruments and lip-syncing the music. But the Bohemian Rhapsody music video was an actual production. It was actually special effects, and it was, you know, different angles and stuff and stuff like that. Like that had never been done before. Prior to them. So, which is ironic because they were credited for creating the music video, which created MTV, and then, you know, later in the 80s they got banned from MTV because of their music video for what's that song again?
The one where they were dressed up as women and whatnot?
Yeah, when they're dressed up in drag.
I
Want to Break Free. Yeah. Which the American audience didn't understand. What they were doing a parody of Coronation Street. Because at that time, the different band members were dressed up as certain characters from that series. So Canadians, like, we would have got that because Coronation Street is a big show in Canada, right? But in the States, it's not. So they did not understand the gag, right? So it got banned. But anyway, my knowledge of Queen to that was their Greatest Hits. And that's kind of was it. So after this film, you know, I went out and I watched every documentary. I learned a lot about this band. So, like, it's funny because last year I left podcasting. And there was two times I really wanted to be podcasting again. Like when I was like, damn it, I wish I had a podcast. One was when the Avengers came out, Avengers Infinity War. And the second one was this film. I wanted to talk about it in the worst way.
I'm sure anybody who follows you in social media could tell.
Anyway. But we'll talk about that in a bit. But going into this film, did you have any expectations when you went in to watch it, Rich?
Not really. I mean, I was just looking forward to seeing the kind of drama about the band. I was actually I guess like the only expectation that I had was I was expecting it to be a bit more dramatic than it actually kind of was, in fact. So that would kind of be the only expectation I guess I really had. And on top of that, I mean, this wasn't an expectation, but I was still very upset that Sacha Baron Cohen didn't do it. I'm still, even having seen the film now, I'm still kind of upset that it wasn't Sacha Baron Cohen. Rami Malek did a fantabulous job with it, for sure, but I still think that Sacha Baron Cohen fit the bill a little bit better in terms of look, maybe not acting skill, but in terms of look, for sure. So, but no, I didn't really have too many expectations. I mean, I saw A Star Is Born, as well, around a little bit before this, actually. So I mean, I had, you know, the music movie mentality already kind of going. And that movie was phenomenal. So, I mean, I expected it to be good, pretty much. That was pretty much my main expectation, is I knew it was going to be good.
Well, to be honest with you, like, I had no expectation going into this film. I really did not follow anything about this film being made and stuff, because, like, I heard about this film being made. I heard about the Elton John one that's coming out this year that was being made. And I'm like, you know, like, to me, you know, like, I had absolutely no necessarily desire to go watch it, because I really didn't care one way or the other if they did this film.
Yeah.
To be honest with you. And then it was one of our local movie critics out of Edmonton, out of Global Edmonton, Todd James. He's... not only is he a movie critic for Global, but he's also a DJ for one of the rock stations in Edmonton.
Oh, cool.
So he did a review of this, and he gave it a very good review. I think he gave it like 4 out of 5, which is a very high review for him. And he said, like, you know, for the diehard Queen fans, they may, you know, not like that they've changed certain aspects for this film of Queen lore, but, you know, I think if you just like, you know, like, I think his response was, if you like a good movie, you're gonna really like this film. So I had no expectations. So it actually came to our local theater, and it was actually my mom that texted me and was like, and was asking me, like, would you go with me to this movie, because I want to go watch it.
And this is when it, like, when did you see it? Did you see it the first week, the first day?
It was probably after a couple weeks after it was released.
Okay. Because I only just saw this, like, within the past month or so myself. I waited until it came out on...
digital.
Digital copy, basically.
Okay. Yeah, no, I it was a week or two after it was released. It actually came to our local theater quite quickly, which was nice. It actually came out the week after our local theater aired A Star Is Born.
Okay, nice.
So my mom went and watched that one with my sister, and then for this one, they had scheduling conflict. My sister couldn't go with her, and my mom doesn't like going to movies by herself, so she asked me if I'd go with her, and I was like, eh, sure, whatever, I'll go.
Did she like the Star Is Born movie?
She did, yeah. She liked Bohemian Rhapsody better.
Really? But, okay, interesting. I'm glad that you clarified that. That was actually going to be my next question.
Well, and then my sister was the opposite. Like, she really loved Bohemian Rhapsody, but she liked A Star Is Born more. Like,
my wife was the same, because I watched both with my wife, and she had pretty much zero Queen knowledge, as I will mention later on in the episode.
Yeah, so, yeah, like, I had absolutely no expectations. So for me, watching this, like, other than, like, I of course I knew that, you know, Freddie died, that I knew he got AIDS, and I knew that whole aspect of his legacy, but I didn't know, like, you know, the, you know, how they met. I didn't know that they were all students, that, you know, well, I did know Brian May, the guitarist. I did know he was an astrophysicist, that he got that degree just a few years ago, like maybe a decade ago or something. He had quit studying astrophysics when Queen took off. He decided to become a rock star instead. And then mm-hmm. after, you know, things kind of settled out, he was like, I'm going to go finish my degree. And he did. And now he's, you know, Dr. Brian May, astrophysicist. So I did.
And rock star, yeah.
So I didn't. Yeah. I did know some stuff. So not knowing and you know too much about it, other than the death of Freddie Mercury, it totally blew me away. Like it totally exceeded any expectations I had. I really enjoyed it. And it was only after the fact that after I'd seen it. You know, I went and watched, you know, like, because YouTube has a lot of Queen documentaries and all that kind of stuff. And they actually did a really good documentary a few years back in 2011 that's actually done by Queen Productions.
I saw, well, I didn't see it, but I went because after the movie, I, much like you, went out and researched a little bit more. Although for me, it was more, I was trying to find out how accurate the movie was. And in doing so, I read about other documentaries, one being that one, which I heard phenomenal reviews about. So I will be watching that at some point this year, hopefully.
Well, and that's the thing, like with this film, like Bohemian Rhapsody, it was actually done by Queen. Like it was done by like Brian May and Roger Taylor, who was the guitarist and the drummer.
They're executive producers or something, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yep. So they actually had a hand in it, and actually, their manager, Jim Beach, who they called Miami in the film, he's one of the producers as well. And he also did, like I said, they did this documentary back in 2011 for the 40th anniversary of Queen. And it's it's less than 2 hours. Well, if you take in all the special features, I think it's over 2 hours.
And the YouTube commercials.
Oh, there's so many commercials with Queen in them now. It's crazy. I just saw one for Valentine's Day for the Women's Network or something.
Yeah.
You know, they had like romance movies and stuff, and they're playing Crazy Little Thing Called Love, and I'm like, yeah, Freddie Mercury. And then TELUS has one for which song are they using? It's I think it was We Will Rock You. I think is what they're using on their commercials. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I believe I have seen that, actually. But, not that I get to see a lot of commercials since I don't have cable, but...
Yeah. But, there's a lot of commercials out there with a lot of Queen. And it's funny, I was actually watching Trainspotting 2, which came out, I want to say 2 years ago. It's going to be 2 years coming up. And I was watching the scene kind of halfway through the film where... Renton and Sick Boy are at a nightclub and they're tripping off on heroin, and they're at this nightclub and they're playing Radio Gaga, and it's this whole scene.
Love that song.
Yeah, it's this whole scene of them singing Radio Gaga with all these other, this whole bar full of, you know, ravers and stuff. They're all high and everyone's having a good time. but yeah, it seems like I'm seeing and hearing Queen everywhere. It's crazy. So your initial response after viewing the film was obviously positive. You enjoyed it?
Oh yeah, I enjoyed it immensely. I would say the few nitpicks that I had were based on knowledge, mm-hmm. or mostly knowledge required after the film, being you know, certain things that they changed for the film to make it more streamlined and to make it a better, you know, dramatic effect and whatnot.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you about that, like, because once I started doing, like I said, watching these documentaries, doing some research, and realizing that they did change certain things. They, you know, like for example,
how they met.
Yeah, like the fact that Freddie was actually friends with Tim Staffel. I think that was his last name. That he was actually friends with the lead singer of Smile. And that he knew of them, of course, and they knew Freddie. And then when Tim left, then Freddie's like, hey, can I join? And then they...
Well, I think he went to school with some of the guys from Smile/Queen before they formed Queen. as well, right? Like, I think he was in school with one or two of them as well.
I think the lead singer, well, they all kind of went to the same school from what I understand.
Yeah.
You know, taking different things. And the irony is, one of the things I read was Freddie Mercury actually lived basically a football stadium's length away from Brian May, the guitarist. But they
American football or British football?
British football. Soccer.
European, I guess.
Well, for the rest of the world, really. It's just Canada and the United States that call soccer soccer. Everyone else calls it football. But
yeah,
anyway.
Exactly.
They literally lived a football stadium's length away from each other, and they never met until they were in their 20s.
Wow.
But yet they grew up that close. Well, Freddie.
You know what? Me and my wife were we lived probably one or two football fields away from each other almost all of our lives, since we were probably about 7 up until we moved in together when we were like 19 or 20. So it was kind of, that's all, you know, it's like, it's a small world, right?
It is. Yeah.
She hung out with all my friends in my neighborhood, and I had no idea she was a thing.
Yeah. It's like, my cousin's, husband was actually my wife's next door neighbor in a town, about 7 hours north of here. Like they were neighbors. And anyway, when I started dating my wife, I was telling my cousin, you know, I'm dating this girl. She's from this town called Fairview. And her husband, like, I think I was on speakerphone or something, and her husband heard that I said Fairview. He was like, oh, what's her name? Her name's Crystal Oliver. And holy shit, that's my neighbor.
That's crazy.
We grew up for years together. And it's like, oh.
That's really cool.
Like you said, small world. But yeah. For this film, they did change a lot of things. And like you said, when I found out about that, I was like, you know, did they really need to do that? But at the same time, you know, like, because basically what they did was they Hollywoodized it. You know, like they changed certain things for drama, dramatic purposes.
And to speed things along as well, obviously. Condense things. You know what? I think the only thing that I still kind of have an issue with that they changed / condensed is the AIDS part of it, like the ending, right? And that's because like they sped it up too much, and I just found it, because like basically in real life, to the best of most people's knowledge, he didn't know that he was, or like he didn't get diagnosed with HIV or AIDS until I think it was like 1987 or so a couple years after Live Aid, right?
Yeah.
And he didn't die until like, what was it, 91 or something like that? Yeah.
Yep.
So they really sped that along, and that kind of that got to me a little bit, because it wouldn't have taken much for them to have an extra 10 minutes after the Live Aid concert. But I do understand that the filmmakers wanted to have Live Aid kind of be the climax, the pinnacle of the film, right? So that kind of makes sense. But it does get to me a bit that they couldn't have told it a little more realistically, just with that. Because, I mean, that's an extremely important part of the band, and more importantly, Freddie Mercury, which, you know, much to the band's dismay, most people are watching this movie to get a better understanding of Freddie Mercury, right? Like, the band wants it to be about the band, and that's why the movie took so damn long to come out, is because everybody wanted the movie to be more about Freddie Mercury, except the band wanted it to be about the band.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I actually think they did a very good job in having it be about Freddie, because there were certain things that the band could have had taken place for dramatic purposes, but they didn't. So I do think that they did this more for Freddie than they actually did it for themselves. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But the fact that they had the AIDS thing at all, they didn't, like, honestly, they did just do that for Hollywood. They did that for the dramatic effect, right? Because, like you said, he wasn't diagnosed until 1987, and then he didn't really come out and talk about it with the band until, you know, 89 or something, they figure.
That exactly.
He finally sat them down. And not just that, but the whole angle of, you know, Freddie, you know, pursuing a solo career and breaking up the band, that never actually happened.
Exactly. That was one of the other things that they dramatized and kind of got to me a bit because I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
Even without researching anything, when that started to happen in the movie, I was like, hold on a second. Like, I don't know a lot about the band, but I'm pretty sure this is fake.
Oh, yeah. No, it was definitely done for dramatic purpose because, they literally had an album come out in 84, and they literally ended their tour for that album like 2 months before Live Aid. So in the film, they make it sound like they haven't toured in years, and this is going to, you know, this could be a disaster, and, you know, there's all this adversity.
Like, yeah, no, when that... in fact, they in real life, they were like, what was it, like 10 months or something that they hadn't toured in, but they were like still together.
It was like 2 months. Their tour literally ended in May and Live Aid was in July. So, yeah, so there was that. And then there was also the fact that, like, they made it, you know, Freddie, he's wants a solo career, he wants to do this. But in reality, I can't remember who it was. It was either Roger Taylor, who's the drummer, or Brian May, the guitarist. They actually had solo albums before Freddie did in real life.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know,
I think they were better too.
Again, it was just an attempt to, you know, create the drama and Hollywoodize it. And I agree with you. Like, that was the sticking point for me. Is like, I don't really like the fact that they did that, but at the same time, you know, they're winning Golden Globes. They're winning this. They're winning that. Like, there's so many. Like, I got a list of awards here that I'll read out later that they've won for this film. And I mean, for the Academy Awards on February 24th, 2019, I mean, it's up for Best Picture, Best Actor for Rami Malek, Best Sound Mixing, Best Film Editing, Best Sound Editing. But I mean, just the Best Picture, Best Actor.
Wait, Oscars? Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Oscars, yeah.
I might actually be doing an Oscar party in my building. I think it might be a little too late to get it organized now, but I was supposed to do an Oscar night because I bought a projector a little while ago, and the board of directors for the building was wondering if I would put it down in the party room and hold an Oscar party. So that would have been interesting. Might be too late to organize now, but...
Oh, it'd definitely be a lot of fun. But, I'll just get into the awards. I mean, they won Golden Globe for film and for Best Actor. To be honest, like, when they won that, I was shocked. Not because I don't like Bohemian Rhapsody or think that it's, you know, I love that movie. And I actually haven't seen A Star Is Born. But from what I've seen and from what I've heard of it, I'm surprised they beat out Bradley Cooper.
I actually cried during that movie. Like, that movie got to me hard.
Well, and I've been saying this for years. Bradley Cooper is amazing. He is a great actor.
So good.
And I mean,
apparently a decent singer.
Yeah, and I mean, Lady Gaga, like, who knew? Like, the fact that she did as good as she did, I was really surprised. You know, but I mean, happy. Like, I think it's wonderful that they won the Golden Globe for film and for Best Actor, but again, you know, considering the competition, but
yeah,
there are people that do say, you know, A Star Is Born is a remake of a remake, right? It's the third time that they've done A Star Is Born. Like, this is not, you know, this is like The Man of Steel. You know, The Man of Steel is not the first Superman movie. You know, it's just a remake of with new actors doing the same thing. And that's essentially what A Star Is Born did. But Bradley Cooper's still amazing. Like, and so is Lady Gaga. But again, like I said, I'm happy that Bohemian Rhapsody did well. So yeah, all these changes that they did for dramatic purpose that we were talking about, like, I guess it worked. Like, I guess, you know, they really, you know, they pulled it off. Like,
Did you, just out of curiosity, so one of the biggest things that I know that they actually kept literally exactly the same, is that final 20 to 25 minutes where they did the Live Aid concert. Mm-hmm. So after I watched that, and that was a very moving part of the film for sure. Like it was an incredible part to end on for sure.
Yep.
So immediately after the movie ended and we watched the credits, which were kind of fun too, because there were some cool little things during the credits of the real band and of the actors and stuff like that, which was kind of fun. But I don't think my wife was paying as much attention as I was after the film ended. But I tuned into Twitter, to YouTube, and turned on the Live Aid concert of their performance and watched the full performance immediately after it to see how similar it was. And then I think it was like a day or two later, I found somebody who actually did a split screen right down the middle of the actual concert and the movie.
Yep.
One on and it's fully, the audio is synced up so that on your left ear you're hearing the Live Aid concert audio, and on your right ear you're hearing the movie concert audio, and it's almost exactly shot for shot. He's wearing everything the same, he's doing the same moves, like everything is so perfectly done that they literally just completely redid it, and it was quite incredible how well they did it, and the audio of it as well. That was actually one of the things that I was quite intrigued by, was how they actually got Rami Malek to sound like Freddie Mercury, and they did that by using Freddie Mercury's voice. So it's not actually Rami Malek singing most of the time. It's from what I understand, it's like a bunch of Freddie Mercury masters that they've gone back and they found a whole bunch of the masters and audio tracks without music and stuff like that. And they had to dig through all of this stuff to be able to digitize his voice, put it into a computer, synthesize it, and then, you know, get as good audio as they could from it. And the part that really impressed me about that was, of course, the Live Aid concert, which, you know, like considering how bad the sound was on, at least on the copy or the video that I watched of the actual Live Aid concert, I'm surprised how well it sounded in the movie. Like they were able to take out a lot of distortion and background noise and all this other stuff and just get pure audio bliss, basically. So hats off to the audio production of the movie for sure. Those guys did an incredible job.
Well, they're up for two different Oscars for that, like for best sound mixing and best sound editing.
Oh yeah, and they deserve to win it for sure. One of the other really funny things too, that you know, watching the movie with somebody who isn't as big, who isn't as big of a Queen fan. My wife isn't really a classic rock type of person for the most part. She, like myself, grew up with a father who enjoyed some classic rock, but a little bit newer. He's a little bit younger than my father, so slightly different generation. Mm-hmm. But she didn't appreciate that music as much. And it was just funny watching the movie, because when they're singing songs, she was going like, oh, that's a Queen song? Oh, I love that song. Oh, I didn't know that was a Queen song. That's a pretty good song. Oh, I've heard that in a lot of commercials before. I didn't know that was a Queen song. So it's really funny, you know, because I'm sitting there singing like, Radio Goo Goo, Radio Gaga. And she's just like, oh, I didn't know that was their song. Like, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. So it was fun to watch the movie with somebody who didn't have as much of a Queen knowledge as I do. And I don't even have that large of a Queen knowledge. So that was a very fun experience.
Yeah, no, I had the same experience with my wife as well. Although she hates Radio Gaga, my wife said she does not like that song at all. She never has. I can't change her mind on it. But I love it. I think it's great. But yeah, getting back to some of the changes, like that, I think that's one of the reasons why Sacha Baron Cohen dropped out. And one of the reasons why either he dropped out or the band or the producers didn't want him, like they had a parting of ways, because Sacha Baron Cohen wanted to go a little bit darker with the material, because one of the reputations that Freddie Mercury had growing up in rock, I guess, was his wild parties and his, you know, kind of whatever you
Which
would call
we it. Did see a bit of.
A bit of, but I guess in real life there's... Yeah, if you watch some of the documentaries, you know, someone, you know, jokes around about how they used to have, like, dwarves...
Giant orgies?
Well, they would have dwarves walk around with bowls strapped to their head with cocaine in these bowls. And then they would have, like orgies and, you know, a lot of debauchery, a lot, you know, people dressed up in drag and
the movie party that he had after he broke up with the girl, was reminiscent of that. You could definitely see shades of that. Yeah. I mean, they didn't go as dark for sure, but you could see shades of it.
I thought
they had little people walking around.
Yeah, I thought they did a good job with it, but there was some people that thought they should have done more. And apparently, Sacha Baron Cohen was that one of them people. Like he wanted to see you. He wanted to do the orgies. He wanted to, you know, see the, you know, that the darker side.
I could just see. And now I'm just picturing, like, a Bruno scene, but him dressed up as Freddie Mercury, basically.
Yeah, and that's what I'm thinking he wanted to do. And
yeah.
And they were like, no, like, that's not the story we want to tell. Like, and the thing of it is, like, no, of course, no, you know, people don't want to really talk about it, right? Like, you know, like they, you know, nudge.
They want
nudge.
To remember him in better light.
Well, yeah, like people will say, "Oh, nudge, nudge, wink, wink." You know, I didn't see anything. You know, but I mean, that was a long time ago. Like that was when they were younger. The you know, back in their party days, and you know, things were done in excess. You know, they were rock stars. You know, now that you know Brian May and Roger Taylor and John Deacon, who's still around. But he wasn't actively involved in the making of the film. You know, they don't really want to kind of revisit that part of their life, you know, like, and especially have it on film, right? Like, I totally get it.
Well, I mean, they probably weren't as big of a part of it either, though, I'm sure, because, I mean, a couple of them were married, or at least had significant others throughout much of Queen's existence. Maybe not all of it, but much of it for sure. So they probably weren't as big of a part in at least the debauchery part of it anyway. Maybe cocaine and all that. But.
Well, they kind of hinted a little bit, you know, like, you know, with Roger and the girls, you know, like he was the womanizer, right? And you kind of seen that a little bit in the movie, but not really. And then there's that line that Rami Malek kind of throws out there, you know, kind of, oh, something about loyalty. And then he turns to Roger's wife and is like, you know, and he kind of throws it out there that he's not being loyal to his wife, you know. And
oh, wow. I missed that.
Yeah. You'll see it in the party scene. Like when the band leaves and they're mad at Freddie, it's because of some of the things he's saying to them. And he does kind of say something like that to Roger and his wife. So, I mean, obviously there was some tension there, too. And, I mean, that's really stuff they don't want to bring up. Like, the whole, like, another thing that was changed was the whole Munich thing. Like, him going to Munich to record that solo album or whatever.
Yeah.
In reality, the whole band was in Munich. Like... For certain albums, they went to certain different places to record. The later albums, they went to Montreux in Switzerland to record. They did a few albums in L.A. They did a few in France. And then they did a few albums in Munich. So it wasn't just Freddie that, you know, like, because in the film they showed, you know, where Freddie, he's, you know, partying. And he's, you know, when Mary comes to see him, he's passed out on the couch. You know, and you could tell by all the empty liquor and drugs and stuff laying about. You know, and Freddie kind of jokingly says, you know, the maid hasn't been in to clean yet and that sort of thing. Like, in reality, that wasn't just Freddie. That was the whole band. Like, they all had their issues. And even, like, when you watch the documentary, Brian May says, you know, like, Munich was a bad place for us. Like, you know, we all got into a lot of trouble there.
Oh, wow.
So, but again, you know, like, the goal is for this, for the filmmakers and for Brian May and for Roger Taylor, who were, you know, the members of Queen that are part of this film in making it, they have 2 hours to or 2.5 hours, whatever it is, 2 to 2.5 hours to tell their story and do it in a positive way without, digging out too many skeletons, and putting too much, bad memories on display, right? But they have to make a movie too. They have to make it engaging. They have to make it dramatic. They have to sell it, essentially, in order to get people to come watch it and then also to win awards with it. So that's a tall order. So there's a lot of things that have to be cut out. A lot of things have to, be left to the imagination and hinted at and sort of, and obviously they pulled it off. Like, to be winning all these awards and doing as well as they're doing, they did it right.
Now, I would actually be interested to know if this movie coming out actually sparked more revenue for the actual band, and not of the movie, not through the movie. I mean, like, through Spotify or YouTube or actual, like, iTunes
for
actual CD sales.
Definitely.
Exactly, like musical stuff. Like, I would be interested to know how big of a jump this movie coming out had for the band's residuals on their actual music, and not like the movie soundtrack or anything like that, but like their actual older albums and stuff.
I guarantee you it's gone up a lot, because I've bought a lot since I saw this movie.
Just through me, they've gotten at least this much.
Yeah, because like I said, before going into this movie, my prior knowledge of Queen was their greatest hits, but they do so much good music that's not part of the greatest hits. Like, what, like an example I will use is the Tragically Hip. They're one of my favorite bands. They're a Canadian band. And they released a greatest hits CD in the early 2000s called Your Favorites. And you go through that list, and yes, they're all hits that we've all heard, if you're a fan of the Hip, or if you're, a rock and roll fan, that sort of thing, you would have heard all this music. But there's a lot of songs that I think are wonderful that aren't on there, so you really have to go by album by album, because there's a lot that, using air quotes, don't fit their greatest hits, right?
With that, then, what are some songs that you love of Queen's that weren't in the movie? There's an interesting question.
Well, one that was, and it's funny because after the movie, I went and watched music videos and I learned more about Queen and learned more about their music. There was one song that you don't hear in the movie, but that was directly mentioned. And it's in the scene where they're at Freddie's house and he's breaking up the band, right? And he's telling him, I need a break. I want to do some on my own. They're paying me $4 million to do these albums, blah, blah, blah. And he looks at John Deacon and says, what's that line from that song that you wrote? I have to fly away. And he's like, yeah, spread your wings. He's like, yes, I need to spread my wings and fly away. That, there's a song that they did on the album. It's called News of the World. And it's called Spread Your Wings. And it's written by John Deacon, their bass player. And it is such an amazing song. I absolutely love that song. I had never heard it before. This song is over 40 years old.
That's the one song that you're sad that didn't make the movie?
I am kind of sad. But but the fact that they mentioned it, and the first, like, when I first watched it back in November, I had no idea what they're talking about. Like, that line totally escaped me. And then when I rewatched it with my wife, it was like, oh. Spread your wings. That you don't hear it in the movie, but they directly reference it.
See, for me, I think I've got two that I'm sad didn't make the movie. One of which I'm not surprised didn't make the movie, but Bicycle definitely is. That's one of my favorite songs of all time that they've ever done. Mm-hmm. I love that. And then the other one would be Big Girls, isn't it? That's another song they do, right?
Fat Bottom Girls.
Fat Bottom Girls. Thank you. I absolutely love that song. It is an amazing song. I'm kind of not surprised that it you know, didn't make the film. That makes sense to me, but I was actually kind of a bit upset that Bicycle didn't make the movie. I was waiting for it the whole time, like, when are they gonna put it on?
Well, and that's the thing. They have such a rich history that there's so much that got left out just because of time constraints. So, you know, thinking back, like, I kind of wish, you know, as much as I love this movie and as good a job as they did, I kind of wish they had just done a miniseries on HBO or Netflix. You know, like when you take, for example, the Netflix series The Crown, you know, they're telling the story of Queen Elizabeth and her rise, you know, to become queen. And then it takes place over several years. And for the new
season. So good. I'm sure you've seen all of it. I've only made it through, I think, the first half season or so.
Oh,
or
really?
Three quarters of a season.
Yeah, I love them. I love the first two seasons. I think it's such a great series. And then
I'm not surprised you with your Downton Abbey love.
I actually don't watch Downton Abbey.
Coronation Street. Whatever. Street, yeah. Same thing, different.
I did try Downton Abbey, but I didn't have time. But anyway, I totally think that this definitely could have been like a Netflix series that we could have seen.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it would have been incredible too, because every episode they could have left off on a huge cliffhanger, I'm sure. Although, well, I mean, it wouldn't be a cliffhanger like you would know a cliffhanger today, but it would be like, what? Like, you could totally easily end each episode on a what moment, right? Like on a big surprise moment.
But The Crown doesn't really do that either. And I'd be okay if they didn't.
Some of them do, but
but most of them actually don't. So I would have been okay with them not doing that. But had they, you know, because I'm sure Rami Malek, because he's a TV guy, if, you know, and Mr. Robot's coming to an end or did come to an end or something. You know,
I couldn't stand that show after the first season.
I didn't actually watch it, but, you know, I'm sure they could have got him for this. But then, you know, getting to the Sacha Baron Cohen thing, like, I think Sacha Baron Cohen, he has the look of the later Freddie Mercury, like the 80s Freddie Mercury. You know, like when Rami Malek, you know, he did a good job, but I always thought he was a little too skinny.
Yeah, he's too small. He's too short and he's too skinny.
Yeah, like, for I sure. mean,
because Freddie Mercury was like, what, 6 foot or something? Like, he was a big guy.
Yeah, he was 6 foot. I mean, I'm 6 foot, but he was a lot.
I don't think Rami Malek is nearly that tall.
No, I don't think so. And to me, he's just a little, Freddie wasn't a big, like a fat dude or anything. He was very slender. He's very slim. But Rami Malek's just a little too skinny, but I think he could, like, he definitely pulled off the 70s, you know.
He's only 0.2 meters shorter. So Rami Malek is 1.75 meters, and Freddie Mercury was 1.77 meters.
Oh, so it was pretty close.
I would have to. So Rami Malek is between 5'5 and 5'6, which I guess would make Freddie Mercury around 5'11 or so. 5'10 to 5'11, okay. I guess. It's give or take.
Yeah. So
that is actually a lot closer than I thought. But yeah, you're right. He is a little bit too skinny. I think it would have done him good to try and put on a little bulk for this role. Well, maybe do a little bit of those Marvel movie workouts that get Chris Evans and Chris Pine in such damn good shape.
Well, I'm thinking if they had done this series on Netflix, or HBO, if they did this as a miniseries, they could have had Sacha Baron Cohen come in as the 80s Freddy. You know, kind of like what they're doing on The Crown, where they had Claire Foy, is that her name, as Queen Elizabeth, but now in season 3 they're going to have a different actress playing the older Queen Elizabeth. I kind of would have been okay if they had done that transition, but I don't know if they would have got Sacha Baron Cohen on board, because like I said, he wanted to do the excess Freddie Mercury. He wanted to do that take on him.
Mm-hmm. And the band wouldn't let them do that, for sure.
So, you know, I think that would have been amazing if they had done that as a TV series. But because, like I said, there's so much that got left out. Speaking of some of the stuff that got left out, a couple of things that I wish they would have done or could have done. I wish they would have had someone playing David Bowie and had a scene with him recording Under Pressure, because that is a fascinating story. When they collaborated with David Bowie, because David Bowie actually, well, you know, Under Pressure, right?
Yeah. I didn't know that it was Freddie Mercury.
Well, yeah, it's Freddie Mercury and David Bowie doing a duet on that's the song.
Oh, see, I knew it was David Bowie, but see, the version of the song that I know is done by the lead singer of My Chemical Romance and the lead singer of The Used or something. Like, I know a very different version of that song, like, well, a cover version done by some emo bands, basically.
Well, you have to listen to the Queen version of Under Pressure. Because that's with David Bowie and Freddie Mercury both singing. And like I said, it's a fascinating story because David Bowie lived in Montreux. That's where they were recording at the time for the album that it was on. And it was John Deacon, the bass player, who came up with the, you know, the riff for Under Pressure.
Yeah.
And the story is, like, he was doing that. And then they all went out for a pizza with David Bowie, like, because he stopped by the studio. And then they're like, oh, yeah, well, let's do a song with this. And they go back, and I don't know, he had a couple drinks, and then he couldn't remember what he was doing. So then it was actually Roger Taylor on the drums. Was like, no, it was like this. Oh, yeah, okay. So then John Deacon remembered it. But them actually recording, because... I guess Freddie was, you know, he was the lead singer. He was very headstrong, you know, when it came to his ideas, and
as most lead singers are.
Yeah, and the way he wanted to. But then David Bowie's just as headstrong. So they actually what they had to do was, when they were recording this, David Bowie would record his stuff and Freddie would have to stay out of the studio. And then Freddie would go into the studio.
Wow.
And then David Bowie would have to step out. And then apparently the story goes that David Bowie was so because Freddie was nervous to be recording with David Bowie. Like, he was very intimidated by him. But it was David Bowie that was also equally intimidated, because when Freddie would be in the studio recording his part, David Bowie would sneak over and, like, open the door and listen in. Like, they caught David Bowie listening in on Freddie to see what he was doing. So I just think that would have been awesome to see something of that in the film.
Now, who do you think would be a good person to play David Bowie, though? Have you thought about that at all?
No, I don't even... I don't even know.
I literally just Googled it. And came up with an article here, and one of them is Tilda Swinton. Cillian Murphy. Well, she actually does kind of look like him put some stardust, Ziggy Stardust.
She's a woman. Oh, come on.
Hey, it's 2019, man. Gender fluidity.
She's already the ancient one, right? From Doctor Strange.
True. There's another one here, Eddie Redmayne. Who else do we have?
Who did you mention before, after Tilda?
Give me a second here. It's just waiting for it.
Because whoever...
Cillian Murphy.
I think I would be okay with him. I love Cillian Murphy.
He does look very good, for sure. He could do that. He does have a good look for it. Let's see. Jermaine Clement as well is another one that people have mentioned.
See, and the David Bowie people. Movie, I would love to see them do a David
Tom
Bowie.
Hiddleston.
Yeah.
Tom Hiddleston. And he's an amazing actor, too.
I could definitely see that, yeah.
Willem Dafoe?
Oh, no. Maybe. Oh, no, not even
he
an
could
older
play
David.
The older. He could play the later years.
Yeah, but even then, David Bowie was... you know, handsome guy, and Willem Dafoe
isn't.
No, that guy's weird looking. Great, like, funny actor and stuff, but But no, I would love to have seen David Bowie in this film. But again, you know, the film ran between two and two and a half hours already. So they're very limited on what they could do. But another interesting story that was cut from the film, and that actually happened in real life, is when they do, like, the scene where they do their tour in the when they go to the USA for the first time. Brian May, like, the first time they went to the U.S., they actually had to cut their tour short, and they actually had to fly back to the U.K. because Brian May actually got deathly sick with hepatitis.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he apparently got hepatitis B when he was on tour in the States, and yeah, they had to cut it short, and he had to fly home, and he was apparently sick for a long time.
Is Hep B the one that they won't let you wrestle with if you get, or is that Hep A?
I think Hep C.
It's Hep C. Okay.
Yeah, Hep C is the one that Pamela Anderson has.
So she definitely can't wrestle.
Yeah, I think Hep C can be sexually transferred, I think, if I remembering correctly. But anyway, he got hepatitis B. Like, he's the one that, like, he got, like deathly sick, like I said. He, you know, it was, and I guess he had to have surgery. And also, I guess he got jaundice. Like, I guess when you get hepatitis, you get jaundice. Like, he literally turned yellow.
I've only heard of children getting jaundice before, of, like, you know, like when they're born or whatever, having jaundice and needing to spend a few days under the lights.
Oh yeah, no, you can, as an adult, you can definitely get jaundice.
I thought it was like scurvy, and it just, you didn't get it anymore for the most part.
I don't know, but apparently with Hep B, like, yeah, it's one of the things that you can get. And he actually talks about it in one of the documentaries. That he was actually worried that the band was going to basically kick him out because, oh, wow, he, you know, because he was in the hospital. Like, he was in the hospital for, like, months, I think. And they were back in the recording studio recording. And because it's one of the special features in this documentary. It's called Days of Our Lives. And Brian May actually talks about how Freddie came to the hospital one time. And he said, like, in the back of his mind, he was worrying, you know, like, the band's gonna, they're gonna get rid of me. Like, they, you know, like, I'm, you know, they're busy recording, carrying on, you know, like, they're gonna have to replace me. And he said, it's almost like Freddie sensed that he was worrying about that. And he came to him and said, like, listen, cause he used to say darling a lot, apparently. He said, listen, mm-hmm, darling, you have nothing to worry about. You just worry about getting yourself better, you know. And when you're ready, you know, you come back to the studio and we'll get these songs recorded. Aww. So I think it was, I want to say Sheer Heart Attack, the album Sheer Heart Attack, where there wasn't a lot of Brian May songs. So yeah, like Freddie was just a stand-up guy. But yeah, like, that was something you didn't see in the movie, you know.
Hmm.
But anyway, so, like I said, I mean, it's up for a lot of Academy Awards coming up. They've won,
and they're good. They're going to definitely win a few for sure. Like, it's going to be one of the films that sweeps the Oscars for sure.
But oh yeah, so here's, yeah, it won Golden Globe. They won a SAG Award for Outstanding Performance by a Male Actor, and that's Rami Malek. And he also won a BAFTA Award for Lead Actor. So I have an article I found online from Rolling Stone about some of the differences between the movie and reality. And some of this we already touched on. Queen's formation wasn't quite that simple. In reality, Mercury was longtime friends with Tim Staffel, that's the leader of Smile, and mm-hmm, was a huge fan of the band long before he joined. Brian May remembers him constantly badgering them about becoming a member, and they didn't relent until Staffel quit in 1970. John Deacon wasn't the original bass player. So in the film, you know, he's just there, like, you know, when Freddie does his first performance, but that's not reality. He didn't enter the picture until 1971. They do show them playing Keep Yourself Alive at the first show, which was indeed an extremely early original tune in their repertoire. Freddie didn't meet Mary Austin the same night he joined the band. So that's his the girlfriend, the love of his life. And actually, when Freddie Mercury died, he left the bulk of his estate and his shares in Queen to her. So she's actually going to be making a lot of money from this film.
Oh, nice. That's good.
So, yeah. Austin briefly dated Brian May, the guitarist. But she didn't enter Freddie's orbit until he was already the lead singer of the band. And another fact, and this is the Mike Myers connection, there wasn't an actual record executive named Ray Foster.
Yeah, I remember reading that.
Basically, that character in the film, the character that Mike Myers plays, is an amalgamation of a number of executives that they dealt with. A number of executives, a number of managers that they dealt with over the years. Like all the ones that told them, no, you can't do this, no, you can't do that. The ones they fought with, the ones that they quit, you know, whatever record label they were with at the time. Basically, he was just an amalgamation of a bunch of different people. Freddie's boyfriend, Jim Hutton, didn't begin as his servant. Hutton was actually a hairdresser, and he worked at the Savoy Hotel. And he met Freddie at a nightclub. And I actually saw an interview he did where the first time he met Freddie Mercury, apparently he wasn't a Queen fan. You know, he wasn't really a fan of rock and roll or anything, which they kind of mentioned in the film. When Freddie says, you know, can you believe, when he's telling his mom and dad, like after they went there to, you know, when he went there to introduce Jim to his family, he says, you know, can you believe that Jim's never been to a rock concert? That's actually true. Like, he was not a rock guy at all. So he actually met Freddie at a nightclub, probably 84-ish, something like that, and Freddie offered to buy him a drink, and he said, no, thank you. And he walked, you know, basically Freddie walked away or whatever, and someone came up to him and said, do you know who that was? And he's like, no. And he's like, that's the lead singer of Queen. And Jim's like, who's Queen? You know, like, he had no clue, right? And then it was like a year later, same thing. Freddie offered to buy him a drink, and he's like, okay. And then they became boyfriend. So
cool.
And we mentioned this already. The group never split up. They all wanted a break. The movie makes it seem like they didn't speak to Freddie for years, but they actually began work on The Works, that's the name of the album, in late 1983, and were never estranged. Live Aid wasn't a reunion. We also talked about this. They released The Works in early 1984 and then toured it all over the world. The last show of the tour was just 8 weeks before Live Aid. And we also discussed this as well. Freddie didn't learn he was HIV positive before Live Aid. But nearly everyone pins it as occurring sometime between 1986 and 1987. He almost certainly had no clue when the group was rehearsing for Live Aid. Stay tuned for episode 2, dropping shortly on this feed. Thank you.